Made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Today's programming is made possible in part by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, providing income to third world artisans by marketing their handcrafts and telling their stories in North America.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. On the program today, the story of 16th century navigator and explorer Ferdinand Magellan. Our guest is journalist and biographer Lawrence Burke Green. He is the author of Over the Edge of the World, Magellan's Terrifying Circumnavigation of the Globe. Magellan led the first voyage to circumnavigate the globe. He did not, however, finish the trip. He died in the Philippines. Magellan, a son of Portugal, sailed on his mission to circle the world for Spain. The two nations were fiercely competitive. Both wanted control of the spice trade. Lawrence Burke Green is the author of seven books, including Voyage to Mars, NASA's Search for Life Beyond Earth, Louis Armstrong, An Extravagant Life, and Capone, The Man and the Era. His new book, Over the Edge of the World, Magellan's Terrifying Circumnavigation of the Globe, is published by William Morrow. Lawrence Burke Green, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. I'm very glad to be here.
Can you imagine yourself as a sailor in the 16th century?
Well, I spent about 3.5 years doing, trying to do just that.
Yeah.
And that was sort of the framework of the book, was to give a sense of what it would be like to be on the decks of Magellan ships, to be among the crew and to see things through their eyes and to experience, and which often meant suffer, the hardships that they suffered, and also partake of some of the rare and exotic pleasures that they experienced. And so it is, if you will, a kind of a hands-on history approach rather than kind of a lofty theoretical work. Fortunately, there are many primary sources and eyewitness accounts to draw from, so I was able to do that with a lot of documentation.
Yeah. There was a memoir translated into English for this book, and there were other many, many sources that you drew on for this book. What was it like reading those accounts and immersing yourself into this time, into this world?
It was like the dead speaking to me, or to readers. It was an uncanny feeling. I was a bit concerned when I started writing this book and researching it that it took place 500 years ago. After all, Magellan's circumnavigation was from 1518 to 1521. And I had been accustomed to writing about 20th century figures such as Louis Armstrong or Al Capone or, as you mentioned, NASA and Mars. And I wondered, how would I bring these ancient figures from the Renaissance and the Age of Discovery to life? And it turned out that they brought themselves to life. It was every bit as rambunctious and vital as anything going on today. And they were partisan. They were emotional. They were fanatic. They were Machiavellian. Goes without saying, it was Machiavellian's era. And the amount of controversy about this particular voyage and backstabbing and mutinies, just the kind of thing, you know, it all had a very, very contemporary ring, and sort of some of the conceptual framework of it. It was really a commercial voyage. There were backers, a banking dynasty called the Fugger family from Germany, who could be very comparable to the Rothschilds or one of the big merchant banking houses that are around today. Backing it, you had jealous partisan politics in Europe, and then you had a global struggle between the West and Christianity and the Arab world and Islam, which also has a very contemporary resonance. But it was more than just a struggle and a pitched battle. This was, after all, much later than the Crusades. There were also areas where these two cultures overlapped and cooperated and melded in various ways that were unexpected and fascinating. So all of this almost seemed to me a way of looking at our own era, but through a very distant and particular kind of perspective.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that, you know, Magellan, of course, was the name NASA gave to an explorer.
Right.
And now we have the Beagle.
Right. Well, I don't think I'll be writing about beagles, but I did, although you never say never. But this idea, the genesis of this book, actually came from NASA, because I've been writing about Mars voyages. The Magellan spacecraft to which you referred was one from the early 90s that was bound for Venus. And was a very, very interesting and successful mission. And NASA scientists who I talked to were very influenced by the Age of Discovery in the way they approached exploration of the solar system. And they kept drawing analogies, conceptual analogies between the two. And, you know, some of them were perhaps far-fetched, but it did eventually pique my curiosity, and I began feeling about, thinking about the real Magellan. And what was he like? And what was that voyage like? And when I discovered there really hadn't been a major book on Magellan since 1890, and that was a very donnish biography by a Cambridge Don named F.H.H. Guillemard, which was a good book in its day, but by our standards was very, very musty, I thought this could be very interesting and to explore.
Yeah.
And so that was how I went from the space race to the spice race. Of course, Magellan was going in search of spices.
Right, right. And but it struck me, you know, that we have, you know, the Beagle was the ship that carried Darwin and
right.
led him to write on the origin of the species.
Right. Well, it's funny, there is a Magellan-Darwin connection, because Darwin retraced Magellan's route through the Strait of Magellan near the southern tip of South America, as did I. I also went back and forth across that route through the Darwin Channel as well as Magellan's track. And Darwin wrote very beautifully about the strait and its somber beauty and lush yet austere landscape. And I quoted some of it in my book.
Yeah. Now, when Magellan set sail in 1519, he had no idea how long a voyage he was embarking on. You want to give us some idea,
yeah.
some sense of what was known and what was unknown?
Yeah. Well, you know, we always know how, you know, science moves forward, and, you know, what people thought a generation ago is of course very different from what we understand now about the nature of the Earth and universe. And you can multiply that by, you know, a factor of 10 or perhaps 100. For Magellan, they did not know about the Pacific Ocean, for example. They thought it was a gulf. They thought it could be traversed in a few days. As a result, Magellan really underestimated, and he was on the cutting edge, he underestimated the size of the globe. He thought it was about 19,000 miles in circumference. And he thought that he could get to the Spice Islands in Indonesia and back to Spain in about 2 years, instead of the 3 that it actually took. In fact, if people had known the real complexities involved in pioneering an overwater route to the Indies, they probably wouldn't have undertaken it, or they might have thought a lot harder about how to do it. So although he was a fanatic on preparations, he was, in fact, really underprepared for this voyage. For example, most of his 260 crewmen were just ordinary, average seamen. They were not specially trained for what was going to be an incredibly sophisticated and demanding voyage. They were just, you know, routine, comparable to merchant marine sailors and who were doing routine voyages. And even the officers, they were generally the gentry. They were Spanish noblemen and a few cohorts and relatives of Magellan who were on the ship. So the few really expert mariners, there were a few of them. There were a few Portuguese pilots, and they were Basques, you know, the Basque separatists. Well, they were around then in Spain as well, and they were known as being very, very hardy and sophisticated seamen, and so they formed an important kind of subculture in the crew. In fact, one of the problems that Magellan faced was that he had men on board from 10 different countries. And we might say, oh, how wonderful, it's a regular United Nations. But in fact, they didn't get along. This led to a lot of mistrust. They literally didn't have a common language, although the convention of the day was a nautical Castilian, which had terms for most of the navigation and objects aboard the ship. It meant that the unity was sorely lacking, which was the and it led to the four or five mutinies that Magellan faced along the way.
Yeah. And how did he deal with those mutinies?
Well, at first he was rather circumspect, and he tried to ignore them. But as they got more and more serious, he eventually executed some of the chief mutineers. So their grievance against him was that they were Spanish, and they were often Spanish noblemen, and they considered him a Portuguese interloper. Now, Spain and Portugal had a fierce rivalry, and they were damned if they were going to serve this Portuguese admiral or captain general. And so they decided to take back the fleet from him, the five ships that were sailing for Spain. And Magellan wouldn't allow that to happen. And the worst mutiny occurred in Port St. Julian, which was just north of the Strait of Magellan, and he actually beheaded several of the ringleaders of that mutiny. In fact, Gaspar de Quesada, one of those obstreperous Spanish captains, he gave Quesada's servant a choice. The servant was named Luis Molina, and he told Molina that either he would be executed along with his boss, or if he beheaded Quesada, his life would be spared. Well, Molina thought about this for about 5 minutes, and then decided that he would do the beheading himself. So in full view of everybody, he beheaded Quesada, which went against the code of everything that people believed in that very authoritarian age, and thus spared his own life. But Magellan didn't end there. He put Quesada's head on a pike and exhibited it to the other sailors as a warning as to what would happen to traitors. A few of the other mutineers were drawn and quartered. That meant their limbs were literally pulled from their bodies, probably by capstans that were slowly turned by some of the other sailors. And we all, you know, shudder today how brutal and how horrible and how inhuman. But I should add that this was the era of the Spanish Inquisition, that Magellan was within his rights to do so. He was authorized to have the power of life and death over his crew. And as we know from sea accounts, other captains did behave in a very similar fashion when they were faced with a mutiny. So Magellan, you know, ruled his men or led his men through a variety of means. Occasionally or usually it was through his brilliant seamanship, his religious devotion, and his discipline. But when they were literally trying to kill him, he retaliated in this very brutal fashion.
Mm. How was it that Magellan, a Portuguese, embarked on this voyage for Spain?
Well, these were very different countries, despite the fact that they were both on the Iberian Peninsula, or are both there. Portugal was small and a kind of an ingrown culture. They're very, very secretive, their voyages. And if this all has a contemporary ring for this, you know, compared to the space age and, you know, Soviet Union and the United States, I think that's correct. Very secretive about their voyages. We don't know much about many of the most important Portuguese voyages. No accounts were allowed to be published. You weren't allowed to own maps. You weren't allowed to write about them. It was all a very secretive culture. Spain, on the other hand, was much more public about their conquests of the New World and trumpeted them, and was a relatively open culture, especially in a polyglot city like Seville, where many of these origins, expeditions had their origins. So Magellan wasn't the only foreigner to come to Seville to seek backing. Columbus came from Genoa, and there were a number of others who went the same path. So after trying and failing three times in Portugal, Magellan renounced his loyalty to the Portuguese king, King Manuel, came to Spain, went to the 18-year-old King Charles I of Spain, and within a matter of weeks had his backing for the first ever circumnavigation. But he sold that to the king and his ministers, who were older and more experienced, on the basis of a commercial plan to not only get a hold of spices, which were the most precious commodity in the world and roughly comparable to oil today in terms of its political influence, but to control seas, because he wanted to go, instead of overland, the traditional route, he wanted to go to the east by sailing west, always west, around the globe, until he reached the Spice Islands. And therefore, they wouldn't have to deal with middlemen. They could get the spices much, much cheaper, and he hoped far more quickly than had ever been possible in the history of humankind.
Yeah.
On that basis, the ministers were inclined to take it. And the clincher, in terms of what Magellan was selling, was that he believed he could find a strait or a shortcut through the South American landmass to the Pacific Ocean. He did that part on kind of a wing and a prayer.
Yeah, what a remarkable kind of intuitive thing there.
We don't really know. There's a kind of how intuitive that was. There were certainly a lot of rumors that such a strait existed. Maps of that day placed it, about 1,000 miles north of where it really was. And there were rumors that a prior expedition had actually explored it before Magellan got there, a prior Portuguese expedition. But again, we just don't really know because of all that secrecy. So we do know that Magellan was the first person, not just the first European, but the first person to explore the strait, to navigate it from one end to the other. But exactly what components went into his thinking are, still worth a lot of debate.
Yeah. What kind of navigational tools did he have?
Well, he had several of them, but they were fairly simple. He had a compass. They had so-called Portolan charts, which were charts used by sailors for harbors, which were helpful when they were still fairly close to Spain and the west coast of Africa. He had some familiarity with how winds and currents work, but certainly nothing by our current standards. He was able to shoot the sun and make calculations like that. But the rest of it, and he was able to read the sea well. We know that Magellan knew how to avoid atolls and reefs and underwater hazards. He was quite expert at that. But beyond that, in some ways, he was just hopelessly befuddled. For example, as we all know from that wonderful book, Longitude, people in those days didn't know about longitude. So he could never accurately, even if they had known the real size of the world, they couldn't have accurately placed themselves on a globe depicting the Earth. Of course, many people didn't agree that the Earth was even round.
Right.
Now, Magellan and the more sophisticated thinkers who were relying on ancient learning from the Greeks realized it was round. And any sailor who went out and saw the mast of a ship slipping below the horizon or the landmass slipping below the horizon knew it was round. But the man on the street, the average person, was prey to all sorts of superstitions and myths and religious beliefs stemming from the Bible about what the Earth might consist of. There were believed to be just three continents, just one ocean called the Ocean Sea, that Jerusalem was literally at the top of the globe, that hell was a geographical location at the bottom, that the Earth was surrounded by kind of water or fogs that kind of floated off into space, that there were all sorts of sea monsters, Amazons, mermaids, a whole huge, you could fill an encyclopedia, really, with the number of widely held misconceptions about the physical nature of the world. And so when Magellan set sail, he was taking on at least 2,000 years of accumulated ignorance and superstition about the world. I mean, when you think about it, it's just absolutely incredible. And most of these tended to get passed down from one generation to the next, from one scholarly authority to the next, in these sort of fantastic compilations that were, very entertaining, but usually very false. Just to give one more example, it was an article of faith that there was a magnetic island out there in the ocean sea somewhere, and if a ship sailed too close, all the nails would be pulled from the hull, and the ship would sink. And also the ocean would boil at the equator. So if the ship sailed too close to the equator, and Magellan had to cross it four times on his voyage, all the sailors would be scalded to death. As you can see, the number of misconceptions was really incredible. So the sailors were terrified, and part of the reason they were so quick to mutiny against Magellan was not only this national rivalry that I mentioned, but they often thought he was trying to get them killed because he was so bold. And the Spaniards aboard the ship believed that his reason for doing so was that he was covertly Portuguese still, that he was somehow furthering the Portuguese agenda, even though he was sailing for Spain, by trying to get a Spanish mission, you know, all destroyed and ruined and whatnot.
Did the crew know what their mission was?
Well, the fleet was called the Armada de Molucca, the fleet of the Spice Islands. They obviously realized where they were going, but Magellan kept many of the specifics of his voyage secret from the men, which only got them more mistrustful. So they had a general idea of what they were up to, but they didn't really know where they were going. And Magellan had a difficult time getting people to sign up and sign on for his voyage. That's part of the reason why he had to get so many different nationalities involved, because manpower was hard to come by, and those who were willing to do so were often people who were kind of dead-enders. They were at the last stop of their lives. They were fleeing prison or crimes or during the Inquisition. Some of them were Jews who had converted to Catholicism. They were conversos. So they were fleeing Europe for a variety of good reasons. So, you know, their situations, various personal situations, were so desperate that even the hazards of this voyage were preferable to what they thought they were facing at home.
Yeah, and the hazards were many.
Yes.
Of 260 men and boys in five ships, one ship, the Victoria, and 18 survivors made it back to Spain.
That's correct. Loss of life in that era was incredible, and often one fleet after another, often bigger than Magellan, would sail out, were lost, never heard from again. You know, it was presumed that all the ships ran aground, that they were destroyed in a storm. So this kind of loss of life, which is appalling to us, was not considered unusual for its day. In our era of the age of space exploration, if a single life is lost, let alone seven, you know, we're all traumatized and in a state of shock and call into question the value of the entire space program. But in Magellan's era, really nobody, they just looked at it in purely commercial terms. They didn't look at it in terms of the value of human life. And as it happened, the survivors of Magellan's voyage, that skeleton crew of 18, brought back enough cloves, the most valuable spice of all, to Spain to make the expedition a commercial success. So the backers made money. King Charles was thrilled. He made money and felt vindicated. So in strictly commercial terms, that voyage was considered a successful one.
Our guest this afternoon, biographer and journalist Lawrence Bergreen. His latest book is Over the Edge of the World, Magellan's Terrifying Circumnavigation of the Globe. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments. The telephone number is in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on the toll-free line in Eureka. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. An interesting conversation. I'd like to ask two questions, please. When I thought of Magellan, I thought of what in the world was it like to go around the tip of South America, and I was wondering if you could describe that, and did he stop anywhere near Tierra del Fuego on that part of the journey?
Sure. The idea was to avoid going around Cape Horn, which is at the tip of South America, because although Europeans knew about it, they also knew it was the worst weather in the world, no exaggeration, and incredibly hazardous. So the strait was supposed to be somewhere in the middle of South America, if you will, far away from Cape Horn. But Magellan kept sailing further and further south into colder and stormier weather at those low latitudes, until he found the strait, which is about 500 miles north of the Antarctic Circle. Then he was able to navigate it, so therefore he avoided having to go around Cape Horn. Tierra del Fuego is is just north of the strait. In other words, it's on the northern shore, and then is actually a very, very large island just north of the strait, as is Patagonia. So the strait is very far south.
I see. He didn't stop anywhere along the way, then, did he?
Well, he would occasionally pull up. He would drop anchor. He would come ashore to escape a storm in search of food, penguins or seals or shellfish or birds, fowl, anything they could find to eat. So they did occasionally tie up in various harbors along the way.
On that part of his journey?
Yes.
I did.
Yes, especially because he was hugging the coast because the storms were so intense. He was always looking for shelter from these intense storms.
I see. And could you refresh my memory, where did he leave from Spain and where did he go?
The fleet actually left from Seville, which, as you know, is inland. Then they sailed down along the Guadalquivir River to the port town of Sanlúcar de Barrameda, from which one of Columbus's expeditions departed. And from Sanlúcar, which is right on the coast and not far from Cadiz, they went on a southerly course, stopping first of all at the Canary Islands, which were just a few days away, to take on more provisions. And then they went down the west coast of Africa, following sort of time-honored routes that the Portuguese had pioneered. And then eventually they headed off, struck out on their own across the Atlantic, rather rapidly, and made a landfall in the New World at Brazil. They expected to get right to Rio de Janeiro, but there were currents that they didn't know about, so they found themselves, quite to their bewilderment, several days sailed north of Brazil. Again, without being able to determine longitude, they never really had a clear idea where they were. But their first major landfall, if you will, in the New World was the harbor of Rio de Janeiro, which had been visited earlier by European explorers. And indeed, some of Magellan's crew had been there before, and at least one of them, Portuguese pilot, had fathered a child on a prior stay whom he met on this day and wanted to take with him but Magellan wouldn't let him.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, we've kind of talked a little bit about spices, and we've mentioned that they were a very precious commodity. Why were they so precious, and how precious were they? Can you give us some sense of their value at this point?
They were more precious than gold. Magellan, in fact, often prevented his men from trading for gold at a very, very cheap rate in the Pacific because he wanted to save room aboard the ships for the spices. And it's hard to put a dollar amount on it because the European economy was so different then. It was largely a barter economy. Different countries had their own currencies, but you know, it was very difficult to figure out rate of exchanges among those different countries. By universal consent, spices had been synonymous with luxury and value, really since biblical times. We think of the three wise men and bringing gifts of myrrh and frankincense with them to Bethlehem. And, curiously enough, the Arabs had controlled the spice trade. It was an Arab monopoly ever since biblical times, and Europeans were only able to get their hands on them after they had made their way through a network of Arab spice traders who had enriched themselves along the way with this time-honored spice route. It was disrupted in 1458 by the fall of Constantinople, which prompted this European search for an alternative way to get a hold of spices. Spices were used for a variety of things. They were used for food flavoring, of course, for embalming bodies, for medicinal purposes, and for aphrodisiacs. But they were also a kind of currency because they were easily transportable. And I think the closest analogy we can make today is with oil, because to the extent that there wasn't a global economy in the 16th century, spices played a very important role in that global economy because virtually all countries were very, very desirous of getting a hold of spices and whenever possible stockpiling them. So that's why spices were so valuable. I think it's a very good question because I know when I began writing the book, I thought to myself, well, spices, what's the big deal? Why risk your life to go get spices? But really what they symbolized was control of the global economy.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller on a cell phone, line 1. Hello.
Hi, good afternoon. I hope this doesn't come across as a silly question, but were pirates among the dangers that Magellan and his crew faced?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's no such thing as a silly question about the Age of Discovery, because it's all very new and different, and I know that I spent half my time asking, quote, silly, unquote, questions, because I think that's really how one understands.
Well, I grew up
and there were pirates everywhere. There were pirates in the Pacific. They were just marauders. There were a number of pirates as they got closer to Indonesia. Some were Arab, some were not Arab. But wherever they went, they found plenty of, thieves, plunderers, marauders, around. Magellan protected himself against them because he brought primitive guns and crossbows, which were very lethal, and cannons. So he felt that he was well defended against the pirates, who tended to really just have bravery on their side and nothing more.
Yeah. Going back to the idea of how hazardous this mission was, this voyage was, it would be almost 60 years before another explorer would do it again.
Well, succeed in doing it again, yes. It's funny, again, a very contemporary thing. When Magellan, one of the things he insisted on when he made this bargain, this contract with King Charles, was that nobody would follow the same route to the Spice Islands for 10 years. And King Charles debated that and then granted that exclusive to Magellan. And as soon as his ships were out of sight, King Charles turned around and formed another expedition to copycat, as a copycat of what Magellan was doing. After that one ship came back with spices, King Charles left for no less than five follow-up missions to the Spice Islands, and they all failed. They went through various routes. One of them was led by the pilot who took over from Magellan and brought the one ship home. That was Sebastian Elcano, who was a Basque mariner. No accident that he was a Basque. He was lost. He died of scurvy on a follow-up expedition. And finally, King Charles just gave up because he was going broke trying to do that. So it was left to the British, who were greatly inspired by the courageous Spanish exploration of the ocean. It was left to the British to really be the next ones to do it. And Francis Drake followed Magellan's route largely around the world. When he went almost 60 years later, there were some significant differences. He went much further north and explored the coast of America, mm-hmm. the West Coast, I should say, up past California and San Francisco and much further north than that, perhaps even. But generally, he was following in Magellan's tracks and managed to make it successfully around the world himself. And in fact, he managed to bring almost everybody aboard his ship, the Golden Hind, and the other ships that went along. So it was a much safer expedition, although it did have its hairy moments and a great deal of danger as well. But navigation had advanced a great deal between Magellan's time and Sir Francis Drake's time. For one thing, the ships were much better. Keep in mind, Magellan went in ships that were 90 feet long or about 100 feet long. They weren't specially outfitted for this extraordinary voyage. They were just used for, the normal ocean trade. And in fact, they were in pretty bad shape when Magellan got a hold of them. They were fairly dilapidated. He spent a great deal of time retrofitting them, we would say today, putting new tar and pitch on them. There was constant talk about caulking them, repairing the leaks, of course, getting new sails for the ships, new rigging. But just to give you an idea of how ill-equipped most of his sailors were, in those days, sailors had a phobia about water and didn't know how to swim. So if they happened to fall in, that was it. Our chief diarist for this voyage, Antonio Pigafetta, who wrote a wonderful account, First Voyage Around the World, which I really recommend to your audience, fell in at one point because he lost his footing aboard a ship and was almost lost. He was just very lucky that he happened to grab a hold of a trailing line from the ship and to call for help, and his life was saved. Well, if Pigafetta had drowned at that point, we might never really have had a detailed day-by-day record of what it was like to sail on these ships. So you know, there were many hazards that they faced, big and little. There were the big ones, the storms and the mutinies, and those little ones, you know, drowning when you lose your footing, or dying of scurvy because people didn't know about vitamin C in those days.
Yeah. Or not seeing land for a long, long time.
Oh, you know, I wondered about that. That certainly would trouble me. It would disturb me emotionally or psychologically. But in the five or six diaries of the voyage that we have, nobody really talks about the psychological toll of being out of sight of land, although they were a lot. For example, on the first leg of their Pacific crossing, after they negotiated the strait and headed for the Spice Islands, which they thought would take a few days, it took them 98 days to make their first landfall, which was Guam. And they were out of sight of land the entire time. Otherwise, they would have landed. I mean, they were very lethargic. They were propelled at a rapid rate, perhaps as fast as 6 knots an hour, by the trade winds, which were very powerful, which they didn't know about. So that was a miraculous discovery. Nobody really talks about what that was like, but one of the diarists, a crusty old pilot named Ginez de Mafra, talks about this tremendous relief of finally sighting the island of Guam and what it was like and how exhilarated they were. And, he describes the way the watchman, calls out, land, 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 ho, land, and the electric feeling that it gave. And he said, you know, anybody who's had that experience would understand what that was like. But that's about the closest approach we can make in terms of what it was like to be out of land, out of sight of land.
How were these sailors received by the peoples whose islands they visited?
Well, boy, that's a fascinating question, and I would say it depended. In some places, they were attacked, and their stuff was stolen, and then it was returned. They often found the behavior of the indigenous peoples whom they encountered incomprehensible because it didn't fit their categories. And their behavior similarly baffled the indigenous peoples. For example, they come to an island in the South Pacific, 5 big black ships, and they're firing their guns, and this ear-shattering report, reverberates off the mountains. Well, you can imagine the effect on the local people, who would be terrified and very, very alarmed by this, salute, which was meant as a gesture of respect rather than war. So there was a lot of misunderstanding and missed signals, quite literally, on both sides. In some cases, they were able to trade successfully, and in many cases, they engaged in enthusiastic orgies, which our diarist, Antonio Pigafetta, wrote about in great detail, and which I recorded, quoted in the book. They certainly got very, very deeply and intimately involved with many of the island peoples whom they encountered, although that was how Magellan died. He died when he got himself involved in a very, very unnecessary tribal war. So they were certainly, Magellan himself, because he could be so rigid and authoritarian, was certainly capable of being a very poor diplomat and inflaming indigenous peoples against him. It prefigures so much of the next few hundred years of the West's often tragic encounters with the East that it's really fascinating and very poignant.
Yeah. Well, at a point in the story where he's in the Philippines and he's in a fight for souls, there is a ring to this part of the story of Conrad's, Kurt's Heart of Darkness.
Yes.
Something happens, and he's off the deep end.
That's right. I think your point's extremely well taken. Magellan seemed to undergo several changes on the voyage. And in the latter part, across the Pacific, that change seemed to be, he was always very devout and always had his men attend Mass every Sunday, often every day. There were shipboard religious observances all the time. Prayers were constantly recited. There were 3 priests among the expedition's personnel. So religion was really woven into the fabric of the daily life of the sailors. And it was a tool of social control as well as belief and devotion. But Magellan seemed to become more and more extreme and fanatic in his religious beliefs when he started converting many of the islanders to Christianity, which was, by the way, not part of his mission. This was a commercial mission. But the islanders enthusiastically embraced it. Now, what they understood and what they really thought about it, we don't really know, because we only have records, obviously, from the Europeans. They were generally visiting pre-literate cultures, so we don't have written records of how Magellan seemed to them. And if we did, boy, they might really be eye-openers. But in any case, they don't exist. But we can speculate that Magellan's god, the one he was talking about, seemed very big and powerful. So they decided that they would forego their idols and their local gods in favor of this, the big one, the great big one that Magellan was bringing with him. Although it's also very telling that when missionaries came not long after Magellan, they found no traces of Christianity. So the islanders threw off those beliefs as quickly as they had assumed them. But Magellan went one step too far when he got to the Philippines and was greeted as almost a living god himself. When one island chieftain decided he would not convert to Christianity because everybody else was, and especially because his enemies were, and he wanted to do the opposite of his enemies. His name was Lapu-Lapu. Once Magellan heard that Lapu-Lapu, who was on the island of Mactan, one of the larger islands, was holding out, he sent his soldiers to burn their grass huts to the ground. Again, very ominous foreshadowing of Western encounters with the East, centuries later. Yeah. Well, as you can imagine, the inhabitants of that village were enraged. Magellan was challenged to a battle by Lapu-Lapu. Magellan was extraordinarily stubborn and stiff-necked and would never back down from a challenge. After all, here was a man who had brought his fleet halfway around the world, and from his point of view, he had God on his side, and nothing was going to make him back down from a fight with a local chieftain, especially when he, Magellan, had armor and he had gunpowder and he had crossbows and et cetera, et cetera. Well, he brought a small band of men into an amphibious landing on Mactan, just 16 men, and many of his senior officers pleaded with him not to do this. Lapu-Lapu was just delighted because they had had time to dig all sorts of traps and trenches on land, and those 16 Europeans, which included Magellan and his illegitimate son and Antonio Pigafetta, that diarist, were greeted by 1,500 furious warriors armed with poison, bamboo spears, and bamboo shields. Well, a pitched battle took place in the harbor. We have a blow-by-blow description from Pigafetta, who fought at Magellan's side. And when the warriors realized which person Magellan was, they went for him, and they kept hacking away in and around his armor, at his neck, at his exposed arms, at his legs. They managed to knock off his plume helmet. He put it back. They knocked it off a second time. And when he reached down for it a second time, he was stabbed in the arm with a poisoned spear. So his right arm was incapacitated. And then when he began to lose his footing, these warriors closed in on him and hacked him to pieces right there in Mactan Harbor. And that was the wholly unnecessary end of perhaps the greatest explorer of the 16th century.
Hmm. We have to wrap up here. Before we go, though, I'm curious, today in the Philippines, how is Magellan viewed?
Well, you know, that's one of these things about what others would have thought of him. Not very well. He is seen as an outsider and a marauder. And in recent years, they've had a great outdoor pageant reenacting that climactic battle in the harbor of Mactan. And every year, of course, Magellan loses. And Lapu-Lapu, who's played by a big film star, wins. And 100,000 people come to see it, and they all roar in approval. So Magellan is seen as the invader and the outsider, and Lapu-Lapu is seen as the great Philippine hero, even though, of course, the Philippines are a very, very important Catholic stronghold in the Pacific.
Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of like Lapu-Lapu Day.
Yes.
Well, there we have to leave it. It's such a fascinating read, a good read, too. It's you'll be turning the pages like like a madman. So Lawrence Bergreen, I want to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon, and I hope that our listeners will look for the book.
Thank you very much. Pleasure talking with you.
Lawrence Bergreen has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is Over the Edge of the World, Magellan's Terrifying Circumnavigation of the Globe. The book is published by William Morrow. And that interview was conducted in December of 2003. The book's still available both in hardcover and paperback. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, let's find out what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the board this afternoon, futures in the wheat pit just a bit higher. They've been moving a bit higher, kind of against the grain with the rest of the floor over the last week. Some strength there. We'll talk with Mike Zuzulo this afternoon of Risk Management Commodities out of Lafayette, Indiana. As those of you who listen on a regular basis know, Mike has always said that wheat needs to lead the corn market up over time. That had changed just a bit as we went through the spring, but I think he's still in that mode. We'll ask him a few more questions about that as we get through the closing market report this afternoon at about 6 after the hour. Wheat was up anywhere between 3 and 4 cents today. The September contract up 4.5, in fact, with a high today of $3.28, the low at 3.18 and 3 quarters. The settlement price there at 3.25 and a quarter. Once again, that price settled 4.5 cents higher. December futures up 3.75 in the wheat pit, the high at 42, the low at 3.33 3/4, and a settlement price at $3.39 1/4 a bushel for the D sweet, up 3 3/4. March contract, a 3.54 1/4 high, low at 3.46. Settlement price there at $3.51 1/2. They were up 3.5 cents. And the May contract up 3.5 as well. 3.60 the high, the low at 55 even. And a settlement price for the May wheat at $3.57 1/2, up 3.5. July futures 3.61 1/2 the high, the low at 3.53 1/2. Settled at $3.58 3/4. They were up 4 for the day. September corn off a penny, 2.12 1/2 the high, the low at 2.08 3/4. Settled pretty close to the center, 2.10 1/4, down 1 for the day. December futures down a penny and a quarter. This is your new crop harvest month, 2.26 the high, the low at $2.22. And December corn futures settled at the Chicago Board of Trade, $2.23 1/2 a bushel. They were down a penny and a quarter for the day. March contract at 2.35 high, low at 2.31 1/2, and a settlement price at $2.33. They were down a penny and a half. And the May futures, a 2.41 1/4 high, low at 2.37 3/4, settled at 2.39 1/4, down 1 1/2 for the day. July futures in the corn pit, 2.45 1/2 the high, the low at 2.42 1/4. Settlement price for July corn at 2.43 1/2, down a penny and 3/4. And September futures next year off a penny at 2.47 with a high at 48.5 and a low at 46.5. From the oat pit, September futures 1.51 1/2 the high, low there at 1.47 1/2, and September oats settled at $1.49 1/2. They were off 1 cent for the day. December futures not quite as weak, off just a quarter at 1.58 1/2 with a high of 60.5 and a low at 56.5. From the soy complex now, bean futures, this is where the heaviest losses for the day came. Dave Dickey, your director of agricultural programming, tells me that beans during the day broke through the 200-day moving average, and that inspired some technical selling. We'll check with Mike Zuzulo about that one. I'm certain it's right, and we'll see just exactly how far the bean market might fall on this tech selling. Although today it did manage to stay up, but rather 12.5 cents lower. Had a low today at 5.95 and a settlement price there in the SEPs at 5.97 1/4. So it came up just off that low. The high for the day in the September beans at 6.06. Once again, the low at 5.95. And the settlement for the September beans at 5.97 1/4, off 12.5 for the day. November beans, 6.16 the high, low at 6.04 1/4, settlement price at 6.07 1/2. They were down 12 3/4 for the day. And the January is a 6.21 1/2 high, low at 6.11, settlement price at 6.13 3/4. They were down 13 1/4. March contract in the bean pit, 6.28 the high, the low at 6.16 1/2, settlement price at 6.20 1/2. Down 12.5 cents in May futures. A 6.28 1/2 high, low at 6.19. Settlement price at $6.23 1/4. Down 11 1/4. July futures 10.5 lower. 6.30 the high, the low at 6.22. Settlement price at 627.5, down 10.5 cents. Bean meal futures 190 even the top, the low at 185.50 for the SEPs, and a settlement price for the September bean meal at 186.80. And they were off 410 for the day. The October futures were off 410 as well. They had a high today of 190, a low at 186, and a settlement price at 187.10. September bean oil down 23, 22.40 the high, the low at 22.20. Settlement price at 22.28. They were off 23. And the October bean oil at 22.48 high, low at 22.30. Settlement price at 22.35. They were down 27. A couple of important things coming up during the closing market report. Cattle on feed report from USDA due out in just a few minutes. We'll talk with Mike Zuzulo about that one. And then if you hadn't made note of this in the state of Illinois, Champaign County, and this should be the case, I think, across the state, LDPs are certainly back in play in the corn market, a 14-cent LDP in this county for the day. So those are things happening at the Chicago Board of Trade and in the cash grain market. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. A higher day today on the Merck. August feeder cattle, 111.20 the high, the low 110.45. The settlement, 110.60, that up 22.5. September, 109.65, the high, 108.80, the low, 108.97.5, the settlement, that up 42.5. October, 108.25, the high, 107.50, the low, the settlement, 107.65, that up 60. August live cattle, 80.70, the high, 79.82.5, the low, the settlement, 80.47.5, that up 70. October, 82.20, the high, 81.05, the low, 82.10, the settlement, that up 135. October lean hogs, 63.02.5, the high, the low, 61.75, the settlement, 62.15, that up 82.5. December, 59.95, the high, 58.80, the low, the settlement, 59.87.5, that up 132.5. February, 60.72.5, the high, 60 even, the low, 60.65, the settlement, that up 65. April lean hogs, 60.10, the high, 59.60, the low, the settlement, 59.97.5, that up 30. And August pork belly, 72.70, the high, the low, 70.25, and the settlement, 71.57.5, that up 72.5. The Dow up 18 points at 10,573. The NASDAQ up 1 at 21.37. The S&P 500 2 higher at 12.21.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carl Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Frank Butcher from London, UK, writes, "Dear Dr. Science, why do radio stations play the most annoying song just as I leave the house? It stays in my mind all day. Is this deliberate? And how do they, A, know when I leave, and B, know what song will really rattle around my head?"
It's all about you, isn't it, Frank? Yeah. Many people suffer from the delusion that the radio is talking directly to them. Most of those are either gullible teenagers or schizophrenics. Well, the fact that in England, where you live, the radio station really is programmed by your personal habits. Yeah. In fact, I've heard the BBC has a whole annoying music library, which they break out just when you're listening. Yeah?